The following program is a Zygon International audio presentation.
Today, the mysteries of our human heritage have lost their force. We appear no longer interested in our underlying psychic selves. Our ability to wonder, to stand in awe of our cosmic environment is in question. How do we recover our roots and recognize our singular place in the grand scheme of life? Perhaps through the challenges of our time, we are embarked upon a 21st century search for the Holy Grail, a vision quest beyond all which have gone before in human history. The challenge of the darkest places in the forest of society may lead us through to the light of a new world. Joseph Campbell, in his classic book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, wrote, "The modern hero, the modern individual who dares to heed the call and seek the mansion of that presence with whom it is our whole destiny to be atoned, cannot, indeed must not, wait for his community to cast off its slough of pride, fear, rationalized avarice, and sanctified misunderstanding. Live, Nietzsche says, as though the day were here. It is not society that is to guide and save the creative hero, but precisely the reverse. And so every one of us shares the supreme ordeal, carries the cross of the Redeemer, not in the bright moments of his tribe's great victories, but in the silences of his personal despair." Today our guest is Joseph Campbell. Join us for a visionary visit with the author, scholar, a man whose work allows us to better understand who we are, where we've been, and where we may be going. My name is Michael Toms. I'll be your host. Joseph, welcome.
Thank you, Michael. As always, pleasure to be with you.
It's good to be with you as well. Joseph, in the introduction, I referred to the darkest places in the forest of society. And perhaps a good place to start is to recall that those dark places have always been with us down through recorded history, haven't they?
They have indeed. And those are what are symbolized, actually, in the forest adventures of the Grail. You mentioned the Grail quest. And there's a wonderful statement in the Quest of El Saint Graal. That's the version of the romance in which Galahad figures. The knights are challenged by Gawain to go in quest of the Grail, to behold it unveiled. And the text says they decided to do so. But they thought it would be a disgrace to go forth in a group. Each entered the forest at a place that he had chosen, where it was darkest and there was no way or path. That's to say, each must find his own path. Following a path, you're following someone else's destiny. And one of the great, I think, spiritual insights of the peculiarly European Western tradition is that each of us has his own destiny and just doesn't run along an already mapped out track.
So often we see those dark places as huge problems in our life, whether we view our life as an individual or our role in the overall society, and we relate to it as a problem as opposed to an opportunity. What does the mythology say about that?
Well, I would say that mythology tells us that where you stumble, that's where your treasure is. There are so many examples. For example, in the Arabian Nights, of someone, let's say, plowing a field, and his plow gets caught, and then he digs down to find what caught it, and it's a ring of some kind. He hoists the ring, and down below is a cave with all of the jewels in it. And so it is in our own psyche. Our psyche is the cave with all the jewels in it, and it's the fact that we're not letting their energies move us that brings us up short. And so it is. The world is a match for us, and we're a match for the world. And where it seems to be most challenging is where the greatest invitation lies to find deeper and greater powers in ourselves.
So we need to push ourselves.
Right. Toynbee, in his history work, speaks of challenge and response. And every culture, as well as individual, runs into these challenges. And if the power to respond fails, then that's the end. But where the power to respond succeeds, there comes a new amplification of life and consciousness.
We seem to be in the place, both individually and societally, of reacting as opposed to responding, as you mentioned, in the sense that if you look at history, just in the past 20, 30, 40 years, one can look at the present and see the same mistakes were there just 10 years ago, and yet we seem to still be reacting in the same way. How can we move into that response mode?
Well, in a personal life, as well as in culture history, there are what might be called cliches of response that become established. I remember as a young man, I'd fall in love in a certain way, and then think to myself, well, how am I ever going to get out of this particular situation? And I would get out of it, and 3 weeks later would be in the same situation with someone who had blonde hair instead of brown. The circumstances seem to change, but the cliche is in one's psyche. And what you have to come to is a new level of understanding of what your relationship to life might be. That's the creative act. But your word is entirely correct. We're responding instead of creating.
Or reacting.
Reaction instead of action.
Yes.
But action requires an innovation.
Yeah.
I noticed writing, you could say this the way you said it before, but then it would be the same thing, you know, that inertia. On the other hand, every sentence is a challenge to say it anew, and the anew is a totally new statement, really. So it is in living life every day.
Sometimes we're afraid of the new. The new is almost like a threat to our well-being. And that's kind of the way it's been down through the ages, hasn't
right.
it?
Right, and you're also afraid of being criticized. It's a sticking your neck out. That's what life is. And this is what every minute requires. And in any kind of creative work, painting, writing, music composition, or inventive action, you're sticking your neck out. And you know the symbol of the Star of David, the two triangles? Well, this symbol occurs also in the Sanskrit tradition in India, and it's placed in the center of the heart. And what it represents is the upward pointed triangle effort to move toward the spiritual call of the new innovating experience. And the other represents the inertia that calls you down to what was done before and the way it was done before. And it's that new thing that's life. Life is always new. There's a growing point. And where you're not at the growing point, you have become more or less a robot. That's the wasteland. People living not in terms of innovative thinking, but in terms of how it was done successfully before.
You know, I recall you're talking about innovative thinking and doing things anew, and in James Joyce's book, Ulysses, I recall when, in one of your books, I recall where you were saying, where you first came in touch with that book, and you was, how do I read this?
Yes.
And you were talking to a friend, I believe, and
yes.
And I think that's an example of what we're talking about,
yes.
And I'd like to hear, you know, your experience, that initial experience of James Joyce, and then how you learned the symbology. And
well, I was in Paris as a student of medieval languages, Old French, Provençal, Middle High German, and so forth and so on. And Joyce at that time, this is back in 1927, 28, Joyce was not known in this country. His Ulysses wasn't permitted in this country. And we had no idea that he had already begun work on the wild thing that was to come out as Finnegan's Wake. And so I went into a bookstore, and there was the blue Ulysses, you know, avez-vous Ulysses, maybe, monsieur? So I got the Ulysses, and I started reading this thing. At chapter 3, I thought I was going crazy. I went around to Shakespeare Limited on Place de l'Odéon, which is where Sylvia Beach, who had published the book, was. And I walked in as an indignant academic person saying, how do you read a thing like this? And she said as follows, and she gave me some information and some books to help me on my way. But talking about innovation, is that not an innovation? Every single chapter is a totally new innovation, and there's no repetition of anything, and this moves right on through Finnegan's Wake and in grand style. This winter in New York, the big thing, for me at any rate, was the Picasso exhibition, you know, 4 miles of pictures by this man. And at the age of 16, he produced 2 paintings, which were of academic perfection. He got into the academy by passing the exam when he was 13. And so what do you do with your life if you're producing academically perfect works at the age of 16? And every step thereafter was an innovation. Every step, as you go from one room to the next. And he was like the growing point, as it were, the growing point of the whole 20th century. Pressure of art into new regions. It's terrific.
It's interesting as we're talking about art and innovation how our society essentially sees art in the area of the humanities and explorations and innovations as kind of a sideline, kind of a, almost like a sideshow, as it were, to the mainstream of life. The mainstream of life being business, getting on with business, getting on with the real things. What about that?
Well, I think one of the feelings today is that we lack roots. That wonderful poem of Yeats, you know, The Second Coming, where he says, turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. I think we feel that in ourselves, we feel it in the society. Where is the revelation? Well, revelations in the past, all the great scriptures, have come from poets and artists. I mean, these are the ones who hear. These are the ones whom we call seers. And it's the function, really, of the poet and the artist to do exactly what Joyce and Picasso have done. Push on into spiritual realms that are waiting to be found. Because our life situation is so radically changing all the time. When you think of earlier centuries, from I'd say around 2000 BC, when the agricultural societies became firmly established, to the middle of the 18th century, we had basically an agrarian world, you know, with the same social orders and the same essential technical problems. And then suddenly everything begins changing. And when you think what's happened since that time, man has been completely displaced from the old ways. And the old systems don't talk to us, really. We try to understand, but we don't feel it. You know, a revelation is not to be explained to you. It's to be immediately experienced with an aha, oh, that's it. And that's the poet's job. That's the artist's job. So I think they're the burning point. The business world is for the most part dealing with solutions that have already been achieved, you know, working them out. But even there, we see them in trouble now. They don't know how to handle these new situations. So there's revelation to be rendered on every level of our life, economic, political, social, emotional. It's a new world we've built for ourselves, and we have to learn to know it.
Joseph, everywhere we look, we see life being planned out, planned out to the nth degree. And whatever profession you want to pick, whatever field of endeavor you choose, whatever your poison, it's there. And it's almost as if we're so concerned with our safety or security or our, in the name of our well-being, we exclude the creative force to really come through. And this is, I think, in the name of technology, this has been done over and over again. And I want to talk, I'd like you to talk about the effect of the technological age that we find ourselves in and mostly our products of, and its effect on our understanding of our own myths, our own creative heritage.
Well, looking at the problem just from the point of view that's brought up by your remarks here, the magnitude of enterprises now requires a, a great, great deal of planning. My principal experience of magnitude in planning is in connection with theater productions, let's say, in New York, where you have a great big Broadway production going on, and it will cost $500,000 or $1 million to pull the curtain up the first night. There has to be a lot of planning, and it all based on expectations of an enormous audience and all of that sort of thing. And the possibility of a creative act is greatly diminished. And in contrast to that, what goes on in the small theater area, you know, with very much reduced expenses and machinery and reduced expectations of audience, the creative thing can go in. You know possibly the kind of audience you're talking to, and the creative dialogue can take place. But when you're talking to, or think you're talking to, audiences of hundreds of thousands, there's very little chance for the creating. You have to think, what are these people interested in? What will they respond to? Will this thing go? So everything has to be done in terms, you might say, of a statistical count based on experiences before, and there's very little sticking the neck out. I imagine it's that way in other areas, producing enormous, actions like those of the space shots and so forth. And a marvelous creative thought to begin with, but then the realization of it involves such an extrapolation of ideas and machines and so forth that a creative thought halfway through, another creative thought would wreck the whole enterprise. And I think we're in that kind of a moment now. And the people who have the privilege, you might say, of the creative act are relatively few proportionately. The rest are those realizing and executing orders. So I think a lot of people just feel their life lacks creative moments and creative experiences. It's all a doing of what you have to do.
So the nature of our society is almost inhibiting to creativity, and yet we hear a lot about being creative, and it's wherever you walk, you hear about, well, I'd like to be creative, I'd like to be more creative. And in a sense, the way we approach our life and the way living in a modern society with all of its technology and the tremendous emphasis there is on rational, linear, logical thought processes, all of which have brought us great blessings as well, at the same time, we've gotten out of touch with that deeper side of ourselves, and perhaps the questions we ask and the problems that we present to ourselves as being so insoluble are really questions that go to a deeper root that lies in mythology, in the mythology of the world.
Well, the value of mythology in the old traditions, one of the values was that every activity in life had been mythologized. You saw something of its relevance to the great mysteries and your own participation in the great mysteries in the performance, in agriculture, in hunting, in military life, and so forth. All of these were turned into spiritual disciplines. Actually, they were. There were rituals associated with them which let you know what spiritual powers were being challenged and evoked and brought into play through this action. Well, now, as I said before, our society has changed so fast that we have not had chance to find what we're doing. And consequently, it's up to every single individual in his own life to analyze his psyche in relation to his life task. And if he finds it isn't working, well, then getting an income from that task isn't worth it. You've got to risk in order to find life. And people go into a work just thinking, well, this will make money for me, not thinking, gosh, this is what has inspired me to life action. They have to face it in the end and find some fighting way to turn their work into a creative experience.
Joseph, you know, you've mentioned this in previous conversations we've had, and I've wanted to go deeper with it with you. Have you ever done anything in your life primarily for money?
No, absolutely not. Well, I would have, I think, but I came back from my student years in Europe in 1929, just about 2 weeks before the crash. And I didn't have a real job for 5 years. And I found then, I don't know whether it would work now, but I found then that a young man, unmarried, didn't need money. I could pretty well take care of myself for almost nothing. And then I took a little vow that I'd never work for money, because I've enjoyed myself just enormously, reading what I wanted to read and so forth. I dropped my work on the PhD because it would have required me to do things that I had already outgrown. In Europe, I had the world had opened up, as I said earlier, Joyce, among other things, but more than that, Sanskrit and the Orient and the relationship of all of this to psychology and all, and I couldn't just go back to finish up that PhD thesis, and I wouldn't do it. Besides, I didn't have the money to do it. And just that freewheeling, maverick life gave me a great sense of the deep joy in doing something that meant something for me. And then I found when I finally, after 5 years, was invited to teach at St. Lawrence College, that they were very much excited by what I had found I wanted to do. And I would not have taken the job if they would not have let me do that, just as I wouldn't take the PhD. And, well, I had luck. I had luck. I don't know how it would have been if I had been married at that time already with a child, let's say. That's something else. I can't speak to that point. But it wasn't by accident that I wasn't married and didn't have a child, because it was my notion that before anything like that, I should be prepared to take care of the situation.
Wasn't there a myth that says you create your own luck?
That's not only a myth. There's a wonderful paper by Schopenhauer called An Apparent Intention of the Fate of the Individual. And he points out that when you are at a certain age, well, kind of age I'm at now, and look back over your life, it seems to be almost as orderly as a composed novel. And just as in Dickens novels, little accidental meetings and so forth turn out to be main features in the plot, so in your life, funny little accidents and what seem to have been mistakes at the time turn out to have been directive crises in the life. And then he asks, who wrote this novel? You see? And you can ask yourself, it's as though it were planned, and there is something in us that's doing this. People speak of people accident-prone. It's something in themselves. They could even be in the car with you and you doing the driving, and it's not good to have them there, what used to be called Jonas, you know? So there's a mystery here. And Schopenhauer finally asked the question, can anything happen to you for which you're not ready? You don't know whether it can. I look back now on certain things that seemed to me at the time to have been real disasters. But the results of it having been a disaster instead of a success turned out to be the structuring of a really great aspect of my life and career. So what do you say?
Many people feel their life novel, as it were, is being written by someone else or being controlled or created by external events. What about that?
Well, I would say the person is letting that happen. And that is, say, what might be called a function of the person's own intention, letting it happen. Also, blaming other people for your situation. I've had a couple of discussions with people, I won't say what kind of people, but who were blaming their whole life situation on this, that, or the other aspect of their character and social situation and so forth. And I just jogged them and said, you know, blaming other people. Look at your own life in relation to that of other people and think of yourself as having certain limitations, just as everyone has certain limitations, size them up and go into the race knowing it. And you'll be functioning then as a human being, not simply as a person of this, that, or another category. And I think that's important. Take it on as your own responsibility and do it. This isn't tough talk either, you know. Anyone can do this.
Don't have to have spent years in Europe and taken a copy across the United States.
No, I don't. I've seen people with far less than that within them make a big job of it and do well.
I'm speaking with Joseph Campbell, author of The Mythic Image, The Masks of God, Hero with a Thousand Faces, many other books as well. And we're talking about the full range of human experience from a mythological point of view. And Joseph, in our society, fairy tales are for children. What about the fairy tale for the adult? The fairy tale for the whole person?
Well, that's a good question. Most of the fairy tales are for children. Those that we like best usually represent a stopping at a threshold. The child doesn't want to grow up, you know? One of the problems in a neurosis is that the person hasn't grown up, hasn't moved from a position or attitude of dependency and expecting an authority into that of assuming his own authority and responsibility. And so, insofar as many adults haven't made that step, those children's stories are for them. But I think the later fairy tales for the great the adult individual are those of our religious traditions. The teachings of the Buddha, the teachings of Jesus, the teachings of Zoroaster, I think these can be read as fairy tales. And what a fairy tale is, really, is a story that is not regarded as being true in the sense of being a historical truth. It's not a fact truth, but it's true in the way of an inward truth as a reference to one's own inward life. And if one reads the scriptures that way, not as references to history, but as references to one's own spiritual interior and its potentialities, then they are, as it were, fairy tales for adults. That's what I would say.
There are many millions of people that, for instance, with the Bible, interpret the Bible literally. Mm-hmm. There was a great flood. There was a Garden of Eden, et cetera, et cetera. There was a fall. What about that literal interpretation of the Bible?
Well, that literal interpretation of the Bible faces the problem of scientific and historical research. And we know that there was no Garden of Eden. We know that there was no universal flood. And so we have to ask, really, what is the spiritual meaning of the Garden of Eden? And what is the spiritual meaning of the flood? Interpreting biblical texts literally reduces their value. It turns them into newspaper reports. Do you know of things that happened long, long ago, and so what? So there was a flood, so what? if you can understand what the flood means in the way of reference to spiritual circumstances, the coming of chaos, the loss of balance, the end of an age, and the end of a psychological posture and so forth, then it begins to talk to you again.
Making the connection to myth, many people, I think, who interpret the Bible literally have perhaps not been exposed or at least have not seen that there are many other similar texts from other cultures down through history that make the same reference points, talk about a deluge, talk about a paradise, and you find this throughout cultures all over the planet.
Well, there's no doubt about it. There was a great German anthropologist, Adolf Bastian, B-A-S-T-I-A-N, who was the first really to make a big point of noting this, that there are motifs, there are themes that occur in all the mythologies and all the religions of the world, with very few exceptions. And he called these elementary ideas. And where do they come from? They don't come from the fact world. They come from the psyche, just as fairy tales do. And that you brought that theme in, I think we can play with it this way. Then he observed also, of course, that in the different provinces of mankind, they occur in different inflections, different costumes according to the place and time. And these he called ethnic or folk ideas. Now these are the two sides of our subject. The folk idea is a historical problem. Why do we have this form here and that one there? But the elementary idea is a psychological problem, a very deep psychological problem. And I've noticed that in India, there are two words that refer to the same two aspects of mythology. One is deshi, which means local, provincial, the provincial, local aspect of the myth. And the other is marga, M-A-R-G-A, which means the path. And the meaning of that is that by casting off the shell, you might say, of the local, historical, provincial inflection, one comes to the elementary idea, which is the path to guide one to one's own inwardmost heart. The word marga comes from a root that means the trail or path of an animal. So you follow the animal, you might say, of the spiritual guide to your own inwardness. That's what myths are good for. And when you follow them, then all the great traditions are talking to the same point.
I'm thinking, you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking of the feelings, the feeling level, and that psyche level that you're referring to. How, again, in our culture, we're trained to kind of put that under, to suppress that, to repress that, to oppress that, as it were. And part of that, I think, revolves around that we've somehow lost our rituals. The ritual was the place where other societies expressed their feelings. We don't have rituals anymore.
It's really astonishing how little ritual we have in our life. Even the rituals of courtesy have gone out. But the function of a ritual, a mythologically grounded ritual, is to engage you in experiencing the myth. A ritual is the enactment of a myth, either in a very literal way or in an extremely abstract way. The ritual of the sacrifice of the Mass in the Roman Catholic Church is the reenactment of the crucifixion. So you're participating in the sense of the crucifixion. And what the sense of the crucifixion is twofold. One, that the divine transcendent has come into the world and has accepted the crucifixion of life. And the other is that the individual has yielded his individual self and being to the grace of a transpersonal realization. So the cross is, as it were, the threshold of the passage of eternity into time and of time into eternity. And in participating in this, you are giving yourself to the Christ. And what the Christ is the Christ in us, namely the knower of the Father. And so understanding it in terms of its what we maybe call mythological or spiritual sense opens the image. And then it doesn't matter, I mean, whether Christ lived or not. Actually, there's no doubt about it that Jesus lived, that he was crucified, that he died and was buried, but it is a little more questionable as to whether he rose again and ascended to heaven. That doesn't matter. That's the mythological statement of the implication of giving yourself. He who loses his life shall find it, is this sense. And that's what we call call the creative act, not hanging on, but yielding to the new creative yielding moment.
Again, as you mentioned, the Mass, the Mass represents an example in the way the changes that have occurred in the Mass over the last few decades, again, where the ritual is attempting to mold itself to the society. And I think of particularly with the Catholic Mass, where the language of the people being used and various and sundry aspects of the Mass being changed, essentially to deal with, quote, the changing times. And I'm wondering if in dealing with the changing times, we're not losing the original sense of where the ritual came from.
Well, in my view, the Mass was a more potent ritual in Latin, with the priest not facing the congregation, but facing the infinite transcendent. Than it can possibly be in the vernacular. And one reason for this matter of the vernacular is that the words of one's vernacular language have all kinds of domestic and earthly and just tawdry often associations, whereas when they're in a sacred language, the pitch is, as it were, heavenward. One of my friends said, just when the church is translating its Latin into English, all the kids are chanting Sanskrit, you know. The wonderful power of these ritualized languages, the rhythms and so forth, you can never match a Gregorian chant in English with a Gregorian chant in the language it was composed to carry. So that's the, my view is that the church has made a mistake there. In fact, I think they're making a major mistake in not realizing that their function is to preserve a ritual and to let the individual experience that ritual in his own sense. Instead, they are changing the ritual and insisting on theological interpretations of the Eucharist and all that sort of thing, the accent on how you are to read it, not on giving you this to let you experience it in terms of your own capacity. So that you get all involved in rational matters instead of in the aha impact of losing yourself in this event.
Because in a very real sense, I think Christ's message was that each of you has this power. Each of you has your own, you have your own capacity to realize this.
Well, indeed, and that comes out even more strongly than in the canonical Gospels, in the Gospel that has recently been translated, the Gospel according to Thomas, where Jesus says, "He who has heard and assimilated my word is as I." And that's good Buddhism. It's an important thing to realize that it's right in you. And I think that's one of the things that the Oriental teachers over here are telling us. Now, of course, we're getting the quintessential thing of those Oriental teachings when they come over here. If you were to go to the country where they came from, you'd find a lot of local, desi, provincial material roundabout that would be just as much an encumbrance as the equivalent over here. And so we're getting the real spiritual message, and what they're telling us is that the spiritual teaching has a spiritual, not a historical, concrete reference. My friend Heinrich Zimmer once said, "The best things can't be told. The second best are misunderstood. The third best have to do with history, biography, and all that." Now, the vocabulary through which the best things are told as second best is the vocabulary of history, biography, and so forth. But they don't refer to history and biography. They refer through this to the transcendent. Deities have to become, as one great scholar now in Germany says, transparent to the transcendent. The transcendent must shine through them. But it must shine through us too, and through the spiritual things that we're talking about. And as long as you keep pinning it down to concrete fact, concrete fact, concrete fact, and say, "Oh, this isn't true because it didn't happen," you're wrong. And we don't say that about a fairy tale, and so we get the truth of it. We should read our religions that way.
In the Bhagavad Gita, that wonderful document that emerged out of India's past and is so relevant to the present, I want to quote from it. "Whatever path men travel is my path. No matter where they walk, it leads to me. Those who sacrifice to the various deities will go to those deities. The ancestor worshippers will go to their ancestors. Those who worship elemental powers and spirits will go to them. So also my devotees will come to me." That quote, Joseph, just brings to mind that all throughout history and all through the ages, human beings have worshipped a god. And all too often, I think, we put God into some kind of a personal box and call one thing pagan and another thing the truth. What about that from a mythological point of view?
Well, from my point of view, which is based on years of study of mythology, there are two aspects to divinities. One, the divine as a personification of the energies that operate in the universe, and the other as a personification of the energies that operate in ourselves. Now, finally, these are the same energies. And so the deity who is thought of as without is also a reference to what is within. And now, in the different ethnic areas, there is a tendency to think of their vocabulary of deities, their pantheon of deities, as being true, and the deities of other people as being false. This is a particularly characteristic attitude of the biblically based religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. When it goes to primitive peoples or to Oriental and archaic religions, that's not the situation usually. There's a tendency to recognize that the deities of this group are equivalent to the deities of that group or of our group. This is particularly conspicuous in the classical world. When Caesar went into Gaul, he wrote in the sixth book of the Gallic Wars about the Celtic religion, but he used the Latin names for the Latin gods to describe the Celtic gods. And when Alexander the Great went into India, his officers recognized in the Indian gods the same gods that they were worshiping. Krishna was identified with Indra, for example. This is known as syncretism, and it seems to be correct. When you confine the truth to your tradition and cut out other people, that gives you a certain privilege in your own mind with respect to them. That is, you have the privilege of knocking them around. The only way to open up to the contemporary world, where there are no horizons of this kind permissible anymore, is to recognize the deities of other people. And that's the sense of the Bhagavad Gita. That's the sense of all the Oriental teachings, really. The gods are guides to something that we're all being guided to, namely the deep center of knowledge and truth and consciousness and life within ourselves, which is one with that within the world.
I think of the Tibetan Buddhist pantheon of gods and goddesses and deities, all representing a particular aspect of life.
Well, you see, in Tibet, as in certain other parts of the Orient, there was an enormous emphasis on meditation. And the degrees of meditation and the inflections of experience that come through meditation, and each of these inflections had a personification. And that's why you get this enormously complex pantheon, because there was an enormously complex tradition of inward experience. Whereas if you don't go inward like that and have all these varieties of experience, then such deities don't mean anything to you. The Tibetan pantheon, in its fullness, would not mean anything to a Western person because he hadn't had the counterpart experiences. But a monk who spent his whole life meditating, and then translating those into verbal and image statements is in tune with that pantheon.
Is there something of psychological understanding to be learned from that pantheon as relative, say, to our understanding of psychology in the West?
Well, for some of the major figures of the pantheon, that's true, but for the exquisite inflection, that's not true. There's a certain mistake in trying to become, let's say, a Tibetan or a Japanese or a Hindu if you are a Western person. What you ought to learn from them is to seek the equivalent mysteries in yourself, but then your own folk idea system has to come through. Everyone has to be creative in his own way, and one can lose oneself. Remember, I spoke earlier of entering the path where there was no path, you see, entering the forest where it was dark. When you enter someone else's path, you're apt to get displaced and feel and achieve a false realization.
Yeah, when we look around, we see religion after religion, group after group, where there is a teacher and a disciple relationship, the teacher and the student, and this is the path, follow the path, do this, do it this way, meditate that way, pray that way. You're suggesting that it should be otherwise.
I'm suggesting this should be otherwise. I think you can take clues from teachers. I know you can. But you see, the traditional Oriental idea is that the student should submit absolutely to the teacher. The guru actually assumes responsibility for the student's moral life, and this is a total giving. I don't think that's quite proper for a Western person. I think one of the big spiritual truths of the West is that each of us is a unique creature and consequently has a unique path. You can take suggestions. I've gone in my life from one teacher to another, not mystery teachers, not spiritual teachers, but teachers in learning, and I leave them behind, just as we leave the music behind that we loved in our childhood for the music of later times, and each finding his own way. There are plenty of guides around, but none should be permitted to say, I'm it. Now, when Jesus and Krishna in the text that you've just read saying, all come only through me, what they're saying really is that they themselves represent that inward truth in oneselves that must be found, and that is the gate. And I think if you read this concretely as meaning you've got to follow so-and-so, namely me, it's being misread. The me that they're talking to is the Christ in us, the God in us, and they're pointing toward it. There's that wonderful little Japanese Zen sign of the finger pointing to the moon. You must mistake the finger for the moon, and that the doctrine must not be mistaken and concretized and say, this is exactly it. It's not Jesus who's speaking, but Jesus Christ. The Christ is the second person of the Blessed Trinity, which is the knower of God the Father, and that's what's within us to be brought to life. As Paul could say, I live now, not I, but Christ in me. And so also Krishna can live in one.
The Trinity is another symbol that we see in all over as well, isn't it?
Well, it comes in various forms and with various interpretations. The three can be read in a number of ways. But the way that is traditional, I think, in the Western Father, Son, and Holy Ghost is the Father is the is symbolic or personification of the ultimate divine. For the Father to be known, there must be a knower. God can be known only by God. Therefore, the second person of the Blessed Trinity is the knower of the Father. And then when there is a knower and the known, there is a relationship between the two, and this is the Holy Spirit. Now, this can be translated into Sanskrit in Sat-Chit-Ananda. Sat means being. This is the Father. Chit is consciousness. This is the Son knowing the Father. Ananda is rapture or bliss, and that's the relationship of the Father to the Son. There's a precise counterpart there. This is a fascinating realization when it comes to one.
Joseph, one of the things you've done in your life, and I never cease to be amazed at the volume of material that you've turned out through your hands in writing, and you edited the portable Jung, and you put a lot of Jung's writings together, and you were just talking about how it's important to see our own uniqueness as Westerners and to come in touch with that and to learn from the East, but we also have our own individual understanding to realize and recognize. And I recall Jung visited the Taos Indians of New Mexico in the 20s when he was able to talk with some of the elders who were literally still in touch with their ancient understanding of who their gods were. And what an influence this had on Jung as a Westerner, as a someone who was exploring the psyche in very deep ways. And I'd like you to talk about that.
Well, I can talk a little bit about my own experience of the American Indian world. It was through, as a young boy, reading American Indian stories and learning something about them, while I was at the same time being educated as a Roman Catholic, that I came to a realization that has stayed with me ever since. And it's a realization that I think can be well coordinated with my Catholic training, but it has a somewhat different emphasis. What I realized from the Indians was that all life was for them divine. The whole world was not simply the production of God, but was the actual manifestation of a divine power, the Wakan or Orenda or Manitou or whatever it was that was manifesting. And that wonderful thing that you learn when you read of the Indian sacred pipe ceremonial, where they hold the stem of the pipe up for the sun to smoke it first, and then present it to the four directions, and then bring it to themselves, and they have centered themselves in this divine world, a buffalo skull as a sacred object, the animal that is the source of their nourishment, being itself a willing victim. And when they say their grace before meals, it's not to an image of God somewhere else thanking him for letting them kill this animal. It's to the animal for having given its life. You know, that wonderful I-thou relationship between the individual and the universe was to me a marvelous revelation and stays with me. And this was something that struck Jung also, as I recall from, I had a conversation with Jung, and I've also read a good deal of his own writings about things of this kind. It's something in quite a contrary position to that of the one who thinks, well, the divine is God out there, and he created the world, and the world is not God, but it's a manifestation of God's power and marvel and all that kind of thing. It's a different slant. But this got into me, and this, I think, is the mystical line, as opposed, rather, to the orthodox, institutionalized religious position. It comes out also in that wonderful book that John Neihardt wrote, Black Elk Speaks, where Black Elk tells of a vision that he had had when he was 9 years old. It was a prophetic vision of what was going to happen to his people. But there's a moment there where he says, I saw myself standing on the central mountain of the world. The central mountain of the world is Harney Peak in South Dakota. And then immediately he said, but the central mountain is everywhere. Now there is a man who understood symbolism, understood cult, and understood the reference. If you want to go to the central mountain of the world, and you are a Sioux Indian, perhaps you should go to Harney Peak. But perhaps you should go to Jerusalem. Perhaps you should go to Rome. Perhaps you should go to Lhasa. Or perhaps you shouldn't go anywhere, but realize that the real central mountain is in yourself, and that this is the cult symbol to put your mind in touch with the idea of a central mountain. Central mountain is the same as the immovable spot under which the Buddha sat. The central mountain is the same as the cross of Christ on the Mount of the Skull Calvary. This is the same thing, and it's right in yourself. That's where it is. This is what that man knew, that American Indian shaman. And it's this kind of wisdom that comes out of simple people, what seem to us to be simple people, non-literate people, non-complicated people, that can open your eyes to the teaching of your own most elaborate tradition, whatever it may be.
Joseph, you were talking about the Indians, and it just brings to mind, again, in looking at the American Indian culture, the role of the medicine man, and it just occurs to me that we don't have medicine men in the same way that we once had them, or the American Indian had them.
Well, the medicine man was primarily one who had a profound psychological experience in adolescence. Let's say the shaman, what's known as the shaman crisis. It's a marvelous subject, this one of shamanism. Typically, the person in early youth is alone, let's say, walking on the seashore or in the forest, and hears a strange music, and it's the music of the spirits talking to him. And a relationship becomes established, and he's got to hold on to that relationship, otherwise he loses his life. Sometimes what's put upon him is a difficult life, and the shaman's life was a difficult one, one of deep psychological responsibilities and experiences, which he himself hardly understood. This is really a form of mystical experience, experiencing areas of energy that are beyond the conscious knowledge.
We may be locking up our modern-day medicine men in mental hospitals, might
we? Well, I think we're doing that. Also, of course, one can go crazy this way. Let's say one can be unable to integrate that depth knowledge. It's a depth experience of some kind of accord with an aspect of nature, to integrate it with one's conscious life and social position. the shaman had a social position. It was a very uncomfortable one. It was one of isolation, actually, of practice of his spiritual craft, and then coming into relation to the society in certain specific ways, in the way of healing. That was his principal role, but also in the way of conjuring the animals of the hunt into manifestation, you know, and knowing where they were, and all kinds of services of that kind, but typically was feared. And the instrument of his song, the drum, was of tremendous power. The high statement of shamanism, as far as our anthropological information goes, it was in Siberia. There it reached an extreme. And the shaman's drum was such a magical power that if the tribe were moving from one place to another, the shaman with his drum on a kind of sledge would follow. No one could walk on the ground that drum had passed, or something of the kind. Their powers are great, and among the American Indians now, I've just heard some reports of people who are in South Dakota at some ceremonies. The shamanic practices are still effective, still working. They're mysterious.
What about other of the Americas? The shamans were also present in other of the American Indian cultures, particularly in South America.
The way down to Tierra del Fuego. Even in Tierra del Fuego, where you had probably the most primitive people in the New World, the Ona Indians and the Yakans, you had shamans there. They didn't have drums down there. The drum camp comes in a little later in the system, but the same themes were attached to the shamanic life there that were in Siberia.
Why do you think, if we have these cultures that were so advanced in a spiritual sense and so in touch with their total environment in so many profound ways, why do you think it was so easy for the Spanish, as it were, to come in and totally decimate these cultures? And I think of Cortez, I think of Pizarro.
Well, gunpowder is a lot to say, and the horse. These people had nothing like this power. On the other hand, you can't downgrade it. I mean, the deed of Cortez and a couple of dozen men in conquering a major civilization, because the Mexican civilization was not a primitive thing by any means. It was a major civilization for its time. Mexico City was as great a city as there was in the world in the 15th century. And those men went in and tore the city down and knocked it out. They had a shock advantage. The shock advantage was that they were white, and they came from the East, and the East is associated with the white, and there were legends and stories of the return of Quetzalcoatl, the white-bearded one from the East, and it has nothing to do with being a white man. It has to do with coming from the East, which is the white quarter of the world. And so they were, until a little bit too late, thought to be actual divinities. And riding on the horse, no one had ever seen anything like that before. And then with the thunder guns, the muskets that they had, they were in before anybody knew what it was. Also, they had the great advantage of the support of the surrounding people of the Aztecs, because the Aztecs had been for centuries conducting wars to collect prisoners to sacrifice. The sacrificial activities were simply outstanding, almost as great as the Spanish activities in sacrificing heretics. The surrounding people, therefore, helped Cortez and told him to take this road and not that one, and so forth and so on. But the guts of those men is just—it's just something else.
What about the Incas and Pizarro? Was this a similar thing?
And these conquistadors—they were thugs, really. They were brutal men, but they knew, and they had courage, enormous. Can you imagine riding down a road with something like 100 men through the great fortress world of a civilization such as Pizarro did, going into Peru?
Many of us been wearing armor, by the way.
Well, that has something to do with it, too. But another thing about the Spanish conquest that's amazing is something like 10, 15, 20 years after the conquest itself, there were already wheat fields and grazing cattle in those places that had been brought over from Europe, you know? It's a fantastic thing. Also behind them was this idea that we have God and they don't have God, and we have special permission to do anything we want to these animals that look like human beings, you know? And the complicity of the clergy in this slaughter, oh, it's an awful story.
I think of Atahualpa. I think there was a story of Atahualpa. The clergyman who was accompanying Pizarro handed Atahualpa the Bible.
Yeah.
And Atahualpa threw it on the ground. What are you giving me a book for? This is not God.
Yeah. And he said, well, you now have permission to kill this man. Pretty grim. That's religion as a kind of, what can we call it? Congratulation of oneself, you know, and putting you in a position above others. It has served that purpose very often.
And in some sense, it's still with us today.
Well, I would say no.
Joseph, another gap in our culture today seems to be the lack of humor, the inability, as it were, for us to laugh at ourselves, to laugh at our decision-making process, to really make fun of it. I mean, our humorists are few and far between, and I think of the myth of the fool, and I think of the court jester, and the role of the court jester in medieval times for the king, and we don't have any court jesters anymore.
We have cruel critics, but we don't have court jesters, that's true. The court jester represented another space, another position from which to judge one's action. Nietzsche says somewhere that in one's action, one should perform with not more than three-quarters of one's energy. That means three-quarters of one's seriousness. That means you should have a perspective on yourself. And humor is a symptom of that perspective. It's basic to religion. I mean, what I would call mystical religion rather than this orthodoxy. The orthodox lacks humor. I don't think I think the Bible, the Old Testament Bible, is the most humorless scripture that I know. There's nothing, there's a lot that's funny in it, but it doesn't seem to know how funny it is. And this has gotten into our whole notion about religion, that it's a heavy job there. It isn't. It's humorous.
I think of the Tarot deck, where the card of the fool is...
He is the one who's gone through the whole 21 cards and now comes out able to live in any category of life and spiritual experience.
So there's a real message for each of us individually in that aspect of the looking for the fool within.
Yes, I think so. This is the trickster god, you know, in the primitive traditions. Almost every non-literate mythology has a trickster hero of some kind. American Indians had the great rabbit and coyote, raven is another, and blue jay. These are tricksters. And there's a very special thing that's indicated in the trickster. He always breaks in just as the unconscious does to trip up the rational situation. And he's both a fool and someone who's beyond the system. Both the somehow combined in the one figure. It's a great figure.
Yeah. The fool is almost the achievement of the fool, the representation of the fool is almost the opposite of Jung's shadow, isn't it?
Well, the shadow acts like the fool when it comes in. That's a disruptive factor. But if you were to add the shadow to the self, it's an aspect of the self that the ego has not, and its system has not assimilated. It comes in, and yes, that's a good idea. I hadn't thought of it quite that way. It is the shadow in Jungian terminology, in all of its depth as well as in its shallower aspect. Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that shadow aspect of ourselves?
Well. This is a complicated subject. Primarily, the shadow is what might be called the Freudian unconscious. For Freud and the Freudian point of view, the unconscious is really composed of traumatic recollections that are no longer recollected. The mechanism of suppression that or repression that represses these unbearable memories has put them all down in the unconscious, so that it's a function actually of one's personal life. But in that function, it connects also with those aspects of one's potentiality that have not been brought to realization. So it has both a threatening and a promising aspect, do you see? And one's afraid to let it come through, and in its coming through, it can be terribly damaging, upsetting everything in one's life.
It's perhaps why our conscious mind frequently tells us you don't want to go into the unknown.
That's right.
That's taking a risk. Watch out, because in taking the risk and entering the unknown, we open ourselves to that buried consciousness within, don't we?
Indeed. Well, look what happened when the LSD thing was a fad, you know. A lot of people broke open depths that they couldn't handle. Now, I remember Joyce, his daughter lost her mind. And I think it was Jung who said to him, "Your daughter is drowning in the water in which you're swimming." And the difference between, and I remember a long conference at the time of the LSD fad among psychiatrists on this matter, and what came out was that the person who loses his mind is really drowning in water in which the mystic swims. The question was, what's the difference between a mystical and a mad experience? And one has to be prepared. In the myths, one has to be prepared to meet a deity. And unless the deity condescends, you know, by protecting you a little bit, the knowledge of God can explode you. And Jung says somewhere, I remember this, that religious symbols are there to protect us against an experience of God. The experience would be too much. And so it comes in reduced form in the ways of the myths, which then protect us against a too heavy breakthrough.
Can I think of other societies and cultures, and particularly in the Americas, that have ritually used drugs, hallucinogenic plants, and et cetera. And in our culture, we have this incredible drug abuse problem, and it is, to some extent, due to the fact that we've lost the ritual use of those substances, which really can be used in a way that expands our consciousness as opposed to making us go crazy.
Well, I imagine something could be said for that. I hadn't thought of it that way before, but thinking of the way in which drugs have been used, and hallucinogens throughout the Americas, and the American Indian system is full of it. And this Castaneda brought out, we know a good deal about it, that now in the Americas. Also shamanism in the North Siberian area, but also in India. When you see the dancing Shiva, that leaf that's in his hair, that leaf-shaped thing, is a hallucinogenic plant, the datura plant. So through vision, one comes to the knowledge of some things within oneself. We've cut that out, and I suppose...
We have the ritual of the cocktail party is about the extent of the ritual we have associated with the drugs in our culture.
Well, that's the sense, you know, of T.S. Eliot's The Cocktail Party, that the performance of the rituals of society can be a religious performance. And in our world, it's not only going to church, but it's also giving a cocktail party that's a religious act. Well, this puts us on a plane with the Buddhist and Hindu traditions, where every act of life, every relationship of life, can be experienced mythologically as symbolic of a religious experience. One finds going into an Indian home as a guest, one is treated almost as a god. The guest is a deity. I mean, that's a religious act, receiving a guest. It's always been thought to be so. The Arab culture is full of this. You know, the guest is under your protection, absolutely. And in the medieval and in the classical tradition as well. And so taking care of your child is a religious act. There's a story connected with Ramakrishna, the great Indian saint of the last century, where a woman came to him and said, Master, I have to admit, I don't love God. This idea has not, as we might say today, grabbed me, you know. Well, he said, is there nothing in the world that you love? And she said, why, yes, I love my little nephew. And he said, there he is. Taking care of him, you are fostering the God principle within yourself.
It's interesting you bring up Ramakrishna. Perhaps if Ramakrishna were around today and emerged, say, in Washington, D.C., they'd probably lock him up very quickly.
Well, he had certain ways of behavior, at least during the time of his sadhana, during the time of his breakthrough into full realizations, he behaved in a quite insane way at times. There were two or three periods in his life when he was really mad for God, and such a person would be treated as insane. And then the adventure would be aborted. They'd give him drugs and things to blow it out, you know, instead of letting him go through the ceremony.
And here's a man who's acknowledged by millions of people as an incarnation of God.
Well, what he had to say was beautiful. I mean, that book that Swami Nityananda translated into English, his Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, it's a beautiful, beautiful experience to read that.
What about your own experience with Swami Nityananda?
Well, Swami Nityananda was a friend of mine, and he gave me the manuscript of this book to just read it over, and he said, if you see any grammatical improvements, introduce them. Well, when I returned the first chapter to him, it looked like a map of the labyrinth. And he then fed me chapter after chapter through the year. And to thank me for this, he invited me to attend some of the very private sessions he was giving a group of three or four people in reading some of the Hindu texts. We read a text of Shankara's, the Vivekachudamani, the golden, the crown jewel of illumination, and a couple of other Vedantic texts. So I learned a lot from him while working on this thing. And he was a lovely man. And also then when he went on to do a translation of the Gita and translations of the Upanishads, I went through everything he did and communicated a bit of what might be called fluency to the prose. Then when he decided to go on a visit to India, I fortunately had a sabbatical that year, and I went to India first with him and spent 2 months with Nityananda visiting the different Ramakrishna monasteries there. Then I met a friend, an art historian in the Prince of Wales Museum in Bombay, and we went for 2 months on a circuit of visiting the different great temples of the Hindu tradition. When the Muslims came into India, they shifted all the capitals so that all the big cities now are, you only find there are mosques. And mosques don't excite me very much. They're majestic, but they don't have the warmth of the earlier Hindu material. And so we went out into the deep, dark, provincial part of India and found these wonderful things. Then my wife, Jean Erdman, came over, and I arranged for 10 dance performances in India, and I got into the field of the modern arts in India and the modern art groups there, and we had a beautiful time. And the great Indian dancers of the time, Bala Sarasvati and so forth, put on special performances for Jean to thank her for bringing her dance over. It's a great dance audience, the Indian dance audiences. They really understood everything that Jean was doing.
I think I remember one of the more striking things I heard about Indian dance, have heard about Indian dance, is that there's something like 32 different eye movements.
Oh yes, at least. and the hand, the mudras and postures and so forth. The Indian dance is extremely interesting. The body's all broken up into pieces, you know, and each one rendered some quite independent of the rest and then put back together again. And every move has mythological references.
I recall seeing an Indian dancer of some repute, and I forget his name for the moment, but do a dance of a deer, and it was quite incredible because you suddenly didn't see the dancer,
yeah,
but there was a deer.
Yeah, Oh, we had a great experience. Manali Sarabhai, who is a beautiful woman, beautiful dancer, and has a fine dance company, invited us for a whole day just to see her. People show us the techniques and how they were doing things, you know, and it's exciting. Yeah. Then we went to Japan, and they are another dance world. I think the Japanese are probably the most competent dancers in the world right now. This is my impression from what I saw in Tokyo and Kyoto.
Joseph, when I read for the first time the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, I was reminded, I know, of Boswell's Life of Johnson, but I was very impressed with as I was with Boswell, with M is the name of the biographer, the remarkable perseverance and dedication that he exhibited in recording all of this material about Ramakrishna.
Well, it was a remarkable phenomenon, the production of this work. And his memory of what it was, precisely that Ramakrishna had said, well, to me it was a real delight working with Nikhilananda as he was translating it from the Bengali, turning it into a fluent prose. It was a good apprenticeship for me, too, because all that stuff got way inside me. And I was working at the same time on editing the posthume of Heinrich Zimmer, so I was pretty deeply into India at that time.
Mm-hmm. It was an interesting combination. I think of Ramakrishna's chief disciple, Swami Vivekananda, who was literally the first Indian to come to America and start talking about some of the wonders of Vedantic philosophy in a way that Westerners could understand.
Well, apparently he was a dramatic phenomenon, a very handsome man, a very striking and presence. And he came to the Congress of Religions at the Chicago World Fair. That was his first appearance, and I think it was the real introduction of a notion about Hinduism to the American people. And it's out of that. Vivekananda was Narendra in the gospel, and it was the introduction of the American people to Hinduism.
What about that relationship between Ramakrishna and, as you mentioned, Narendra or Vivekananda? It was a very interesting relationship the two of them had.
Well, Ramakrishna had a little company of disciples, and one gets to know them as one's reading the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, just as Jesus had disciples, just as the Buddha had disciples, just as almost any teacher will have a special little group of disciples who are gifted people and people who have really given themselves over to being the disciples of this teacher. So Narendra, who became known then in his later days as Vivekananda, the word Vivekananda means the ecstasy or rapture, ananda, of discrimination between the real and the unreal. That's what Viveka is. He became the principal representative to the world of what Ramakrishna had taught. He had a talent somehow for not only for organization, but also for interpreting Hinduism to the Western world.
He also was perhaps the most severely questioning of Ramakrishna's close disciples. He was always asking Ramakrishna to, well, explain yourself, sir.
Yeah, he's right in there all the time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the others went on to become very important monks in the Ramakrishna movement, yeah, in India, which has a very strong role in India, I found. Wherever we went, there was an important Ramakrishna center.
I want to go back to Buddhism for a moment, you were talking about dance being perhaps at its most evolved form, or at least at a pinnacle in Japan in current times. And the difference in Buddhism in Japan as opposed to as it's practiced in Tibet, as it's practiced in India or Sri Lanka. What about those differences in Buddhism? What do they represent?
Well, just as Christianity is different, and was different in Persia, in Egypt, in Europe, in Western Europe, in Eastern Europe. So Buddhism has adapted itself automatically to the understanding and mode of life of the people present. Buddhism went through, or to do it in big broad outline, an enormous transformation in the first century A.D. The earlier form of Buddhism, which is known as Theravada, also known as Hinayana, or little ferry boat Buddhism, is a monastically oriented religion. The difference between life in the world and the experience of nirvana, or transcendence of earthly passions, is regarded as something that cannot be realized fully except by total cutting off of the normal earthly way of living and moving into the monastic life. Then in the first century AD, a reverse position was achieved, namely that living the life of the world, you are there. Now that's the Buddhism of the North. That's the Buddhism. It originated in Northwest India, as I say, in about the first century AD, and that's the Buddhism that passed into China and Japan. Whereas the earlier Buddhism had already gone to Sri Lanka at the time of Ashoka in the 3rd century BC. And so you find in Sri Lanka and in Thailand, and I don't know how it is now in poor, beaten-up Cambodia and Vietnam, but when I was in those countries, this earlier form of Buddhism was there, and you see a great many monks, all over the place, and the lay community supports the monk community. Then you go to Japan, and you find Buddhism in the art, Buddhism in flower arrangement, Buddhism in the tea ceremony, Buddhism in the decorum of life, you know, and the monks, although there are monks, are not so greatly in evidence. There are two kinds of Buddhism now, let's say, in the Japanese area. One is the Buddhism of what is known as outside power, where you have a image of the savior, for instance, Amida Buddhism. And it's through addressing yourself to the mythology and imagery and prayers of that saving presence that you come to realization. Whereas, on the other hand, in Zen, which is the other kind of Buddhism, that's inside power. You don't ask for a savior. You are your own savior. You find it in yourself. These two Buddhisms are very much alive in Japan. Then when you go to Tibet, what you have is a very strong emphasis on monastic Buddhism, on meditations, and on that enormous pantheon that you spoke of before. These are different possibilities. And what they are derived from are different sutras, different religious texts, different ways, as though a different Christianity might come out of, say, the John Gospel from out of the Matthew, Mark, or Luke. That isn't what happened, but such a thing would be the way to explain what happens in Buddhism.
Also, of course, in Tibet, prior to Padmasambhava's arrival, who is acknowledged as bringing Buddhism to Tibet, there was the bone religion, which was the worship of nature spirits and nature mysticism. And you find parts of that obviously ancient bone nature mysticism in Tibetan Buddhism.
Well, the two interact. One characteristic of Buddhism, you see, that is in contrast to that of Christianity as a missionizing religion, is that Buddhism does not eliminate the deities that were there before. It says these deities are manifestation of Buddha consciousness in the mode of this culture. And so they keep them. In Japan, I heard that when the MacArthur people took a census of religious beliefs in Japan, they found that there were more religious believers than there were people in Japan, because everybody was both a Shinto and Buddhist believer. The local deities are manifestations. Well, the Franciscan monks over here in America had somewhat of that too. These people who are dancing the dances in the pueblos, you know, the pueblo dancers, they're Catholics. There's the church right there, and there's the primitive earlier religious system as well. And that kind of thing it's a powerful force, because the old religion is not refuted thereby. It is sublimated, you might say, and its energies are brought into the new.
I'm speaking with Joseph Campbell, and I wanted to return, Joseph, to one of the points you were making about the literally amazing capacity of Buddhism to place itself in literally any culture and become a part of that culture and honor and acknowledge the culture of which it becomes a part. It's quite extraordinary compared to other religions.
Yes, well, it's based on a fundamental Buddhist thought, namely that Buddha consciousness is ubiquitous, is everywhere. And the goal of Buddhism is to make the individual aware of the Buddha being, the Buddha consciousness in himself. Also, it accepts what the world produces and gives. I spent about 3 years helping a Tibetan monk write his autobiography. This was about 8 years ago. And he had been a tulku, then say one who was regarded as a reincarnation of a monk who'd been reincarnating since the 16th century. And he was taken into the monastery when he was about 5 years old, and so his whole life was spent in the monastery. It's a wonderful, wonderful story. And he left Tibet exactly the day the Dalai Lama did. He was in Lhasa, and he was actually at the Dalai Lama's summer palace called the Nabulinka at the time of the communist bombarding of the palace and attempt to take the Dalai Lama and the Dalai Lama's flight and then the massacre of people in Lhasa and all this kind of thing. It's a hideous story, the departure from Tibet. His teachers had been tortured and murdered, and his schoolmates and friends and so forth, monastery companions. And I've never heard a negative word about the Chinese from that man. I've never heard a negative word of what had happened from that man. It is all Buddha process. And there's that Buddhist idea of what's called mutual arising. Enemies arise mutually, and these situations are of a transcendent source. And I learned from him what religion is. It's a perfectly beautiful thing. Unfortunately, when his book was published, the publisher massacred it, took the whole guts out of it, and just gave us the beginning and the end. Whereas the great thing about the book was it's telling us of all the details of monastery life in Tibet, which now is finished and we'll know nothing about otherwise. I may try yet to get it published decently.
You know, it brings to mind, as you're talking about, that acceptance of, again, the relationship in ourselves between accepting and the wanting to control.
Oh, that's the whole mystery. You know, to have the mind submit, it must try to serve, you know, not dominate life. That's a major point in so many mythologies. The mind dominating life is really Satan, and life speaking through the mind is the power of the Christ. That's a basic thing. It's the Buddha theme as well.
And we have things like wanting to control our environment.
Our relationship to the environment is a bad one because it's been one of exploitation, you know, and we're suffering from that now.
But
I think something's happening. People are beginning to realize this is a dialogue between civilization and its landscape that must be recognized.
Recently, I remember hearing one of our political leaders who's concerned indeed with, I think it was the Secretary of Interior, talking about how we have all of these parklands or all of this wilderness not being used, meaning that it needs to be used for forestry or planting somewhere. There was this, again, that there's so much evidence of this wanting to control nature, wanting to control the environment.
Yes.
Somehow the nature is there to be exploited in whatever way we can figure out exploiting it.
Well, it shouldn't be exploitation. It should be a kind of fosterage, you know. When a tree is cut down, a tree should be planted, something like that. But I think it's beginning to get into the mind now, what's called the ecological movement. It's something that's being realized a little late. I think not too late.
Well, Joseph, I think you're one of the great ecological movers of our time, dealing with the ecology of the mind, as it were.
Thank you, Michael. It's lovely to hear.
I want to thank you for being with us, Joseph.
Well, sir, as I said in the beginning, always a pleasure to be with you. I feel I'm talking to a brother.
I've been speaking with Joseph Campbell, the author of The Mythic Image, The Masks of God, editor of The Portable Jung, author of Hero with a Thousand Faces. My name is Michael Toms. I'm wishing you well.